won't last, because cops in America kill an average of 3 people per day. With police now often forced to wear body cameras and cell phones serving as citizen cameras, there seems to be a constant stream of shocking cop killings on the nightly news. North Carolina, Oklahoma, here in Chicago, and in too many other places to count, have all seen major protests against police violence in the past weeks. Storefronts are being boarded up, and many wonder if they will stay that way all summer.
I mean, if someone knocked out on election night and they woke up today and you told them everything that was happening, if they didn't really pay that much attention to politics, aside from like the media telling them that Trump is bad, they would say, oh, Trump's still in power. I feel like the cops throughout the country, even in Chicago, have become even more emboldened than last year.
The George Floyd protests in 2020 were highly politicized by the Democratic Party, but many wonder if the party will encourage the same confrontational stances in 2021. President Joe Biden reportedly discussed deploying the National Guard to all 50 states ahead of the Floyd verdict, while some Republican-led states are introducing often shocking anti-protest legislation.
The protest that we saw in 2020 was more of a prelude than anything, because now that all these facts are out there, now that, like, you know, there's a huge light shining on police violence and how this is connected to the state and how the state continually arms the police no matter what they do, even if they've just murdered a 13-year-old kid, what is the state going to propose? More money to go to cops to train them, and that training goes to nothing.
The United States has become so divided that the threat of socioeconomic violence now occurs on a regular basis. Underpinning it all appears to be the widespread perception of a lack of justice caused by a fundamental corruption which appears almost impossible to remedy. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Israeli regime seems to be living in an unprecedented state of restlessness after a rocket reached what the Dimona mayor calls the most secure area in the world. Many observers consider the event as a clear intelligence and defense failure, whether the rocket was purposely aimed at the Dimona nuclear site or not.
There is much confusion among the Israelis. This unprecedented breach led the Israelis to question the capability and readiness of the Israeli home front and the capability of the military and political leadership. They are linking this event with other events in the region, mainly concerning Iran and Syria.
The military official statement changed its story on the explosion in an apparent confusion, first saying a Patriot rocket hit the Syrian rocket, while a later statement admitted that Israeli defenses failed to intercept it. Israel claims that SA-4, a long-range projectile handled by Syria's Russian-made S-200 missile system, had been fired at an Israeli aircraft to defend Syria from an Israeli attack, but had, quote, overflown its target and landed near the Dimona nuclear reactor. Israeli media have questioned the official clarification.
There are several questions that the Israeli army needs to ask itself. In the heart of this, there are continuous operations of the Israeli Air Force against Iranian targets in Syria. We have to say honestly, we began this. It began with the attack of the Air Force on Syria, and the Syrians always launch air defense rockets. The Israeli army's analysis is that if they wanted to target the Dimona reactor to retaliate for Natanz operation, they would have fired a more precise missile.
The missile incident came days after Iran warned that it will retaliate for a recent Israeli cyber attack against its Natanz nuclear facility. While the Israeli regime continuously targets Iran's nuclear facilities, it exclusively maintains a military nuclear program and arsenal with hundreds of nuclear warheads, which threaten the entire MENA region.
There is clear that the West is overlooking the Israeli nuclear program despite the fact that everyone knows that this secretive facility holds a military nuclear reactor for around 60 years now. They have an arsenal of tens of nuclear warheads. This nuclear threat is part of the Western hegemony over the region, and it was originally built by the West.
Analysts believe this event foreshadows a certain incapability of the Israeli military to protect its home front in the case of a war with the resistance, which could fire tens of rockets daily. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeidah in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week, and a number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Hodeidah.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
Some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not. Greece taking away quarantine and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states and maybe in terms of age or gender. Are some states not using AstraZeneca at all? And I fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
About 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed.
The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 7-0, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
A crisis this deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The funeral of 59-year-old woman, and only her close relatives are performing the last rites. Her family says she didn't die of the coronavirus, but due to lack of space in the hospital. The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic has brought the country's healthcare on the brink of collapse, As hospitals struggle with lack of resources and space, the country is battling with lack of oxygen supplies and spaces to cremate the dead ones.
We are running out of space here. We have cremated around 40 bodies since morning. This is crisis. We are tired and overwhelmed.
Just a mile away from the crematorium, a truck loaded with oxygen cylinders is preparing a delivery to some nearby hospitals with police protection as oxygen tankers and cylinders are being looted in some parts of the country. This truck loader says, "We are working 24/7 to deliver as much as we can. So are the ambulance drivers."
This is war, not a pandemic. We are restless. We are running out of ambulances and oxygen supplies. But we are trying our best to save lives.
On Friday, India reported over 330,000 fresh cases of coronavirus, which is the highest daily increase the country has recorded so far. Over 2,200 deaths were also reported across the country, with the state of Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh, New Delhi and Madhya Pradesh being the worst affected. The country has recorded 15 million cases so far and more than 184,000 deaths. Health experts say the unprecedented second wave could be blamed on a double mutant variant strains and recent religious gatherings and election campaigns, which has brought the healthcare to a breaking point.
India's coronavirus crisis is deepening further with each passing day. And the country is in a grip of a devastating second wave of the virus. Many unforeseen issues are cropping up and severely hampering the country's fight against the virus. Health experts believe the country's health system is on the verge of collapse, blaming the government's unpreparedness and failed policies for the country's failure to tackle the second wave. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
No one eats or drinks anything during the day. Restaurants and bakeries are all closed. This is not neither because of threats or the COVID-19 pandemic. What has created such an atmosphere across Afghanistan comes from a religious belief that prohibits Muslims from drinking and eating under the name of fasting. Ramadan is the name for one of the holiest Islamic months and is the ninth month in the Islamic lunar calendar. The rising of the sun marks the beginning of fasting and Muslims are allowed to break it after sunset. Now let's see how Afghans break their fasts when the sun sets. The approval for every Muslim to break their fast is Azan-e-Maghrib, or the call for the sunset prayer. That is why almost all Muslims first do their sunset prayers before breaking their fast, which is called iftar. However, iftar time is a specific time for Afghans as they traditionally and religiously get together at their homes or at restaurants. The gatherings are called iftari. There are special dishes and drinks in the Afghan food culture for iftari.
Iftar time is very important to our people. We prepare some special dishes and drinks for iftar, such as duk, tea, fresh juices, and some local dishes, including bolani, sambasa, ashak, manto, qabili, and kebab.
Many here also see the fasting month of Ramadan as a time for boosting their family relations and social ties by inviting others for iftari.
We have many traditions and customs to mark the holy month of Ramadan. For instance, most of us use Ramadan as an opportunity to invite others for iftari. This is based on our religious and traditional beliefs that, of course, strengthen our social ties.
In the meantime, there are also poor people who are in urgent need of food and shelter during the holy month of Ramadan. Our religion teachings urge Muslims to support them as part of duties of a fasting Muslim. Therefore, some individuals and charity groups set up food distribution programs for poor families during the holy month. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Cool.
COVID-1 vaccine was proved safe during the first phase of the human trials. And now the second stage suggests it also provides effective immunity against the coronavirus. Produced by the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, COVID-1 was injected to 280 volunteers in the second clinical stage. And the results were reported to the health ministry.
We passed the first and second clinical stages, and in the next 2 days, we will report the results of the second phase to the regulatory bodies. So far, we have achieved promising results as to the efficiency of the vaccine. Once this phase is complete, we can then speak with certainty about the exact percentage of the vaccine's efficiency.
Once the second phase is over and the vaccine is proved effective against the coronavirus, the third and final stage will then be initiated, which involves giving the jabs to 20,000 volunteers. COVID-1 authorities say they have already issued the call for voluntary injections since time is running short.
Based on international standards, if a vaccine gives at least 50% immunity against the virus, it is viable and can be mass-produced. We are confident from our lab tests that COVID-1 is effective and can generate significant number of antibodies, so we have already issued a call for volunteers to study its efficacy on a larger statistical population.
The first phase of the clinical trial was carried out in December last year, which proved that the vaccine is safe and will not cause any side effects. Other than COVID-1, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, including COVPARS, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
COVID-1 is already ahead in the race compared to other Iranian local vaccines. Now, as the fourth wave of the pandemic is sweeping the country, COVID-1 developers say they're making their utmost efforts to get their jabs to the market within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the US. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee. the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Yesterday was the anniversary of the Haifa Nakba. That's when out of 70,000 Palestinian residents, only 2,900 remained. Zionists ethnically cleansed the rest. That was in 1948, and now in 2021, the regime in Tel Aviv is accused of regularly taking Palestinian land, destroying their homes, clashing with Palestinian youth, and killing and are arresting many others. And this month of Ramadan has been no exception in occupied Palestine. I'm going to cross over to Ramallah, joined by Mona Kandil. Mona, thanks so much for being with us. I think most people have seen these settlers and cursing at Arabs and clashing with them. Tell us about this and, in general, the overall situation there right now.
Well, what happened that in the last few days, hundreds of Israeli settlers were rushing to the streets of East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, clashing with Palestinians and Palestinian worshippers, trying to prevent them from reaching the Al-Aqsa Mosque to perform the Al-Isha prayers and the At-Tarawih, especially that we are in the holy month of Ramadan. They were chanting slogans including death to Arabs and death to Palestinians. At that time, the Israeli forces claimed that they were intervening in order to separate between the settlers and the Palestinians. However, the Israeli forces defended the settlers, attacked Palestinians, arrested over 50 at one night, and wounded over 105 Palestinians. It's obviously that the Israeli forces would be defending the settlers and protecting them. This is why the Israeli settlers would continue their attacks on the Palestinians. The Jihad movement stated that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. The entire Palestinian people would stand behind the Palestinians living in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and that the Jihad movement will not allow the settlers to defile the Al-Aqsa Mosque. All Palestinians will thwart the enemy's plot. Also, there was condemnation from several states, including Jordan. It blamed Israel for the violent attacks. The Jordanian Foreign Ministry called on Israel as an occupying regime, and it's responsible for East Jerusalem as an occupying power. It should respect the international law and end the provocations and aggression against the residents of the city, because they know that the settlers will not go by themselves to attack the Palestinians without receiving and getting a green light from the Israeli regime itself.
All right, thank you so much for that update. That's Mona Kandil out of Ramallah. I'd like to welcome my next guest out of London, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest, Sami Hamdi. Thank you so much for being with us. Sami, why do you think that we're seeing an increase in this violence during this month now of Ramadan?
I think there are two things we should be looking at this situation. The first is the unique circumstances of this particular clash. Since the start of Ramadan, over the past weeks, there have been a number of videos circulating on social media on the Israeli front, there have been videos of two Palestinians on a train slapping an Orthodox Jew. And on the Palestinian side, there has been a video circulating of Jewish settlers pointing at Arab settlements and stating that they are going to kick the Arabs out, kill them, and that death to Arabs. And therefore, there's been a heightened sense of provocation in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, in recent times. And this is also been compounded by increased restrictions on the movements of Palestinians during the month of Ramadan. Is the government of the Israeli occupation says it's in order to control the flow of movement because Ramadan sees increased crowds. But the Palestinians argue, and justifiably so, that this is just part of a continuous pattern by which Israel tries to bully the Palestinians and tries to assert and demonstrate its authority over the people that it occupies. And this essentially boiled over one night when these extremists, even by Israeli standards, essentially hundreds of them, went towards the Palestinians and chanted death to Arabs. And as your reporter stated, the police tended to be easy with the ones who were chanting death to Arabs and heavy-handed with the Palestinians. But if we're widening the angle and looking at the broader context, the reality is that Tel Aviv is becoming increasingly concerned over or Netanyahu in particular, that he's struggling to form a government and he's beginning to entertain the prospect of including these extreme elements in Israeli politics. And by extreme, I mean extreme in their manifestation of their hatred, not in the fact they have hatred, which tends to be across the spectrum. But Netanyahu is mulling including these extremists in his government, and that has empowered them. Okay. And moreover, Tel Aviv is increasingly concerned that with elections coming in Palestine, this might unite the Palestinian factions. And Biden, unlike Trump, is at least willing to restore diplomatic ties and relations with these Palestinians, which the Israelis do not want. They
okay.
prefer someone like
stay
Trump.
Stay with me, Sami. Let me get my next guest in on this conversation out of Amman, award-winning Palestinian journalist Dawood Qutob. Thank you so much for being with us. Dawood, your take on this overall situation. I mean, if we look at history and how all of this came about to begin with, and it seems like there is a disconnect between the reality, because I started off talking about the Nakba, the reality of how this entity came about being able to exist, and what is propagated now, and how that affects the whole. Because as our guest there, Sami, said in London, the tempers are very high on both sides of the spectrum. But we're looking at Palestinians who many of their families still have the key to their homes. But on the other side, we have these Israeli settlers who really believe in all of their hatred and racism that they belong there and that they even have the right to say death to Arabs and to curse Palestinians out in general. Your take on this?
Yeah, well, what we have is a situation where the lies of the Israelis are catching up to them. The Israelis are presenting themselves as an enlightened people, as a people who respect other religions, and they want Jerusalem to be this shining city where everybody can have their own prayers, and they have the faithful, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews. That's the image, that's the narrative that the Israelis have been drawing. But in reality, the Israelis don't want that. They want the city to be exclusively for Jews. And we actually had the first shot of this on the first day of Ramadan. The Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall, or the Barak, the Israelis were having a swearing-in ceremony for soldiers, and they didn't want to be interrupted by the call of prayer, by the Isha call of prayer, which was at 8:29, and their event started at 8. So they asked the Islamic Waqf to stop the calls for prayer, and they said, no way, that's our tradition, we do it 5 times a day. And so they literally broke in to the 4 locations of the minarets, and they cut the electricity so that the call of prayer didn't come out. That's how they are, that's the reality versus what they say. They say, we want to have everybody to be together and so on. And the same happened 2 days ago. They all said, you know, everybody has a right to expression. If Palestinians say Allahu Akbar, oh, they, you know, shoot at them and they stun grenades. But the Israeli settlers and the extremists say death to Arabs, and they're, you know, protected. They have the right of expression, and they're the right to basically mess up other people's lives. So this disconnect between the narrative of wanting to have equality and the rights of all the worshippers And the reality, which is that Israel wants to control the city, wants the city to become more Jewish, and wants the Al-Aqsa Mosque to disappear and to build the Jewish temple in its place. That's the problem. And until the Israelis realize that the Palestinians are going nowhere, that the Muslims and the Christians are going nowhere, that their holy places are important to them, that the Jordanians are the custodians of these holy places, and respecting the status quo means accepting whatever there is. If there is a loudspeaker calling for prayer, you have to respect it. That's how you do it. You have to respect the church bells. You have to respect the Jewish calls. That's what it means to respect. But if you want the city to be Jewish, then you have a problem.
Okay. Well, what about that, Sami? I mean, if they want to be Jewish, I mean, basically, they basically said it's a Jewish state. And what we see as far as many of the laws and very apartheid-like laws or situations inside of that, how do you bring the two together? I mean, according to what Dawood was saying, on the one hand, they want this image of being this liberal, democratic society, but we see how extreme they are, and especially if we're looking at what is happening right now, as again, during this month of Ramadan, whether we're talking about those clashes and dealing with the settlers, or whether we're talking about the pretty regular bombing of Gaza, we see very much extreme and violent behavior.
I think for Israel, the image is important primarily because it's the manner in which it ensures that Europe and the U.S. Can continue to support it with essentially a poker face, with a face in which they say that it's an issue where both sides can be wrong, where both sides are transgressing, and where we are trying to find a peaceful solution. Israel says we want everybody to live together. But I think nobody is really deceived by this image, even if it has significant utility in politics and how the conflict is presented. The reality is that everybody is fully aware that Israel believes in establishing a state that stretches from the Mediterranean to the Euphrates, and that the Palestinians believe, legitimately so, that their land was stolen, that there was theft of the land that was stolen, and that the international community is now trying to find a legal framework within what is called the two-state solution in order to justify and legitimize this theft of land. So on one side, you have a resistance, and on one side, you have a colonizer, and the international community at the moment seems to prefer the colonizer over those who are occupied. And it's important to stress that this is a region in which Algeria was not given its independence, it had to take it, and neither were the other countries that were colonized. And that's the harsh reality that is facing the Palestinians. The reality is that the Israelis want to push the Palestinians out of Jerusalem. They want to make life hell for the Palestinians so that they can get up and move out of Jerusalem so Israel can take it. And it's important to stress this point, in that to make life hell for them to move, because the Israeli narrative is that the Palestinians sold their land, that they willingly moved, and that the Jewish population moved in. Israelis keep on emphasizing this narrative, especially given that Trump is no longer in power. Trump, who had no regard for any narrative whatsoever, and simply said, take what you want. But the other issue, and I'll finish on this particular point, is that Israel is now facing a dilemma in that it's expanded as much as it can with regards to of maintaining a Jewish majority. And one of the reasons that Netanyahu didn't annex the West Bank is not because of international pressure, but because he doesn't know what to do with this Palestinian demographic that will enter the Israeli state. He doesn't want to give them citizenship because he wants to ensure the Jewish majority. But they are there, and he needs some way to deal with them without incurring international uproar that might force them in order to put the spotlight on Israel. And that's a dilemma Israel is having. It wants the Palestinians to up and move, and it's trying to pressure them to do so without actually publicly ousting them in a violent way. That's the dilemma that Netanyahu, the dark dilemma that Netanyahu is facing.
Okay, well, Dawood, on a weekly basis, I mean, we still see the Palestinians protesting, showing their resistance, and of course, still young Palestinians are getting injured, are even killed. Now, and as we've talked about already about how this is deteriorating during this month of Ramadan, how likely is this to lead up into another intifada?
Very likely. What we're seeing since 2 days ago is that the protests are spreading in Qalqilia, in Ramallah, in Bethlehem, in Hebron, in Gaza. So there are protests in different locations. You have to understand that we're also on the eve of elections in Palestine. And the issue of Jerusalem is a big headliner because the Israelis are refusing to allow Palestinians to vote in East Jerusalem, and because they're saying this is our city and you're not allowed to it, even though they signed an agreement called the Oslo Accord, or the Declaration of Principles, in which Israel accepts that a number of Palestinians can vote in post office boxes, a kind of absentee voting. They're saying that's not going to be allowed anymore. You know, they think because Trump gave them the embassy in East, in West Jerusalem, that they have a right to basically violate their own agreement. And that's also, I think, fueling the protests, is the Palestinians feel like they've been disenfranchised and they're not allowed to connect with their fellow Palestinians. They're not allowed to join any political parties that are based in Ramallah or Gaza. And they're being persecuted and arrested. And they're saying, we're not going to stand for this. And people are uprising or intifada. Now, the irony is that the Israelis are now calling on Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, to tell his people to quiet down. Well, I mean, sorry, you've been telling Palestinians for years that this is not, they're not allowed to have any connections with Mahmoud Abbas and with the PA. And now you want the PA to come in and to help you down. It doesn't work that way. So we have a big problem in that the Israelis have yet to understand that 330,000 Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, Muslims and Christians, Palestinians by nationality, will not accept to be Zionist or Jewish, and they're not going to fall in and pledge allegiance to the Israeli flag. They are Palestinian nationals, and that's what Israel has to deal with.
Okay, well, Sami, when we're looking at the overall situation, and we see that the Israelis, they're always aggressive, but especially when dealing with Gaza, regularly bombing Gaza and, of course, using as an excuse that it has been fired upon. In your perspective, what is the real reason that Tel Aviv has shown no mercy at all towards Gaza?
I think it's important to look at it from the Israeli perspective when it comes to Gaza, which is that when they kept Gaza between the Palestinian Authority, Gaza is the greatest threat. Gaza is the one that poses more of an antagonism than perhaps what has appeared to be a more pliant Palestinian authority. That's the first and foremost. So anything that comes out of Gaza, it's essentially a public win for the Israeli government, which tends to point and say, look, there's your enemy, they are the people who want to kill you, so you should worry about them. And the reason why I mention this is because it's important to look at the context within which Gaza is being bombed now, which is that Netanyahu didn't get his majority. Netanyahu is struggling to form a coalition. The parties don't want to join Netanyahu in his government, and therefore he needs time in order to come to some sort of agreement. And in order to buy that time, he needs to deflect Israeli public attention. So he does that by bombarding Gaza with such force and such pounding that it essentially distracts international attention from Netanyahu's woes towards Gaza. So the Israeli population say that Netanyahu is justified in bombing Gaza because they are a threat, because they are firing rockets. And the international community says, we call for peace, but because they dislike Hamas, because they believe that Hamas essentially is an undesirable organization, as we saw in 2006 when they rejected the elections that Hamas won, the international community doesn't come to the defense of Gaza, but rather urges restraint. Moreover, when we look at the stance of Egypt, the stance of Saudi Arabia, the stance of the Arab states, many Arab states which are normalizing ties with Israel, Israel knows that there is no longer this united Arab front that used to at least make Israel think twice before bombing Gaza. So essentially, for Netanyahu, he wins politically, he wins time to form his government, the international community is not going to do anything, Hamas struggles under the pounding bombardment, it increases Palestinian disillusionment amongst the younger generation who are tired of war. I mean, that's a very harsh reality, and the reality I'm very uncomfortable to mention, but it's certainly an element that is appearing in some areas of Gaza. So for Netanyahu, if we remove morals and we remove principles and we remove the idea of justice, for Netanyahu, it's a win-win situation to bomb Gaza whenever he's politically in trouble. And that's why we're seeing the bombing of Gaza in recent times. It's because Netanyahu is in trouble politically.
Okay. Well, Don Wood, there was a missile that landed near the Dimona nuclear plant. How much has this unnerved the regime, as its Iron Dome did not stop the missile, and it's exposing its vulnerability overall?
Well, I think in three ways that this attack bothered the Israelis. First, that it came from Syrian territory, they say, in areas that are under Iranian control, and B, that an Arab country dares send a missile all the way down to the Negev area, and C, the fact that they, whether intentionally or unintentionally, came close to the Dimona nuclear plant, which is a way of telling the world, you're always against the Iranians and talking about the nuclear energy, but you don't do anything about the Israelis having a nuclear plant, and they're not being regulated or observed. So I think on three different levels, the attack, which nobody was killed or injured, I think sent, as you said, a lot of worry among Israeli military and strategists, that is this a beginning of a process, or is this a one-off? Is this just a warning to the Israelis not to interfere with the U.S.-Iranian talks and to allow the end of the sanctions? Or will we see a lot more of this? That's the real question.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sammy, because I'm just about out of time, but looking at the Israeli regime and their aggressive actions, do you think that it is actually increasing its own danger as resistant groups now are becoming more and more adamant in stopping this regime more now than at any other time? Your take, 1 minute.
History shows that colonial powers don't last. The British ruled half of the world and they no longer rule half of the world. The French were kicked out of Algeria forcefully, Algeria where I'm from, and also Tunisia as well. We saw that just 50, 60 years ago, colonial powers were still in their colonies, and now they no longer are. We tend to view the world only through our generation, but we forget that it was not long ago where we saw the world looking very different. And I think the world is moving, and the reality is that the occupation will not last, whether it's this generation or the next generation or the generation after. The injustice will be rectified. And this is what Israel is worried about more than anything else.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us. Award-winning Palestinian journalist Dawood Qutob out of Amman and editor-in-chief in the International Interest, Sami Hamdi, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out from Tehran.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Over 250 international organizations are demanding urgent action from global governments to address the hunger and famine faced by hundreds of millions, a crisis the group said is driven largely by policy choices, including ignored appeals for global ceasefire and humanitarian funding. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, People Are Not Starving, They Are Being Starved. Over 250 groups demand rich nations provide urgent food assistance. Please stay tuned for the details. Over 250 international organizations are demanding urgent action from global governments to address the hunger and famine faced by hundreds of millions, a crisis, the group said, is driven largely by policy choices, including ignored appeals for global ceasefire and humanitarian funding. These people are not starving, they're being starved, the group wrote in an open letter released on Tuesday, April 20th. Referencing the countries where they operate, including Yemen, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Burkina Faso, DRC, Honduras, Venezuela, Nigeria, Haiti, CAR, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Sudan, where they operate, the group said, these girls and boys, men and women, are being starved by conflict and violence, by inequality, by the impacts of climate change, by the loss of land, jobs, or prospects, by a fight against COVID-19 that has left them even further behind. The letter signed by the International Council of Voluntary Agencies, Oxfam International, Danish Refugee Council, and Save the Children was released a year after the World Food Programme, WFP, Executive Director David Peasley warned of the threat of multiple famines of biblical proportions. Despite that grave warning, the group said in a statement that so far this year donors have funded a mere 5% of the United Nations $7.8 billion food security appeal for 2021. Every day, we share stories and evidence of hunger, starvation, and increasing humanitarian needs. Yet this does not prompt urgent action or sufficient funding, they wrote. It is human action that are driving famine and hunger, the group said, and it is our actions that can stop the worst impacts. The letter asks the states to immediately provide $5.5 billion in food assistance to reach those who are a step away from famine. That amount, the group's statement noted, is the equivalent of less than 26 hours of the $1.9 trillion of countries spend each year on the military. Given conflict's role in driving hunger, global leaders must also work to end conflict and violence in all its forms, including by heeding UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' call last year for global ceasefire so that humanitarian assistance can reach those in need. There is no place for famine and starvation in the 21st century, the open letter says. History will judge us all by the actions we take today. Oxfam International Executive Director Gabriela Butcher said there is no time to wait. The richest countries are slashing their food aid, even as millions of people go hungry. This is an extraordinary political failure, said Butcher, urging them to urgently reverse these decisions. And we must confront the fundamental drivers of starvation. Global hunger is not about lack of food, but a lack of equality, she added. Inger Ashing, CEO of Save the Children, issued a similarly scathing statement. We have warned donors over and over again their inaction is leading to death and despair among children, as we see in countries across the globe every single day, Ashing said. That thousands of children will be dying of hunger and disease in 2021 is a political choice, she added, unless governments radically choose to help save the lives of children. WFP warned last year that 270 million people were on the brink of starvation. Receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in December on behalf of the organization, WFP's Beasley said that the award was more than a thank you. It is a call to action.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.